This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
On March 29th, 2015, representatives from some of the over 800 nonprofit organizations in the Nanaimo region gathered at Vancouver Island University for Startup Nanaimo's Profit for Nonprofits Unconference. The event was designed to bring together minds from a variety of sectors to discuss, influence, and inspire revenue generation capacity. Organizers facilitated conversation and collaboration among participants with the goal of developing definitive next steps for action.
Guest speaker Lee Heron, executive director of Fernwood NRG, shared key information and lessons learned from his Victoria-based organization's shift to being enterprising a decade ago. Fernwood NRG currently operates 2 licensed daycares, manages 10 3-bedroom affordable housing units, publishes a community newspaper, holds 2 annual neighborhood festivals, and operates the Cornerstone Cafe.
We devote our full hour on air today to share Lee Heron's talk from the Profit for Nonprofits Unconference, edited to fit within our broadcast time. Here's Lee Heron.
A profit is a financial benefit that is realized when the amount of revenue gained from a business activity exceeds the expenses, costs, and taxes needed to sustain the activity. I think we know what a business activity is, yes? It's selling stuff, goods, services. You got it. What does this mean, though? Revenue exceeds expenses. That's how we make a profit, right? Isn't that just ripping people off? Isn't that what we think in the nonprofit sector, that if revenues exceed expenses, we're actually taking advantage of someone somewhere? Well, it turns out you can make a profit by doing that. You can exploit people. You can externalize costs onto society or the environment. You can try to create a monopoly, and some successful business people have done just that, or something near to it. You can cozy up to your friends in government. We call that rent-seeking in econ land. But there are laws. We may think that the standards that the law sets are not high enough, but there are laws. There are minimum standards in all of these areas. And consumers increasingly are asserting themselves to ensure that companies that try to use these abusive practices are sanctioned and start to feel it in their bottom line. Okay, then. So let's run down the capital of the company, right? We'll stop reinvesting. No more paint, no new computers, no training. Cut all those discretionary expenditures and just try to make as much money as we can, as quick as we can. So is that how a business makes money? By looking like it's going out of business? No. All right, so then we're back to ripping people off, right? We price above the market. Yes? No. These practices aren't sustainable either. Any business that tried these things for any period of time would end up not being in business. And we're talking about businesses here, but the same is true for us in the sector if we start to think about how we operate a little bit differently. So here's some novel ideas, and I hope these don't sound too crazy. What if people are lined up out the door because they feel like they're getting something that's really valuable to them? What if you're efficient behind the scenes, not in the way that you're short with people at the counter, but in how you manage things in the back? What if you maximize the use of your assets? If you're creative, ingenious, or you're innovative, or you take a risk that no one else is willing to take? These are not the only ideas that people have about how to make a profit, but they are some, right? And what I'm trying to show in all of this, just with this quick introduction, is that there's nothing necessarily unethical or illegal about making a profit. Ideally, you would combine some of these ideas, or many of them, to create a business enterprise that has longevity, what they would call in business speak as a sustainable competitive advantage. That's what we're trying to do here. You can do well while doing good. And I would argue that all of these positive traits of business are good for our community. So what does this last word mean then? sustain. If you're an executive or a senior manager in a nonprofit or a company, or if you're on the board of a nonprofit or a company, you already know what I'm about to say, and it's obvious. There are some expenditures that we cannot defer. Rent, utilities. Try deferring your wages and salaries and see how well that goes. Taxes and mandatory remittances. You can't get around these things. We have to pay our suppliers for the goods that they ship us, otherwise they'll stop shipping. Yes? But there are lots of expenses that we can defer. And almost every company, nonprofit, especially startups, has deferred one or more of these types of expenses in the past. I'd like to think we don't cut corners on safety, but sometimes we say, oh, well, you know, we can repair that stair next week, right? Well, if someone falls through it this week, it'll be a problem and you'll wish you hadn't done that. Fresh coat of paint makes people feel better, makes the customers think, hey, look, this place is looking good. Tools. We need tools to do our work. Repairs and maintenance. Funding capital replacements. We need to put money aside for the roof. Pro-D. Training. These are one-time or occasional expenditures, but they're needed to sustain the business. Sure, we can defer them, and we have. We've all done that. We've all made that decision at some point. But we can't defer them indefinitely. We can't eliminate expenditures of this nature. We might try to ensure that people in our organization are paid fairly across the board. We might try to reward people for service or for demonstrated achievement on the job. We might like to improve our benefits package through time to ensure that it's competitive with other sectors and so on. We'd like to pay people more because inflation keeps going up, yes? Our staff might love us in the nonprofit sector, and they might really think that our mission is fantastic, but if we defer these expenditures or investments for too long, it's going to start to cost us as well, isn't it? We'll lose good people, we won't be able to recruit good people, word will get around. However, when we make these investments, it's a permanent increase in our operating costs, right? If we decide to pay people a dollar an hour more, I tell my staff this, $1 an hour more for one person is roughly $2,500, right? So if you have 10 staff in your program and you each want a dollar, that's 25 grand. It's got to come from somewhere. There's this category of expenditures. These are the types of things that we really might think are more in the nice-to-have category. Wouldn't we all love to have a person dedicated to communications and marketing? Wouldn't we love to do research? Huh? Business development. You need some money to start something new. Create positions so that we can provide more service to the community. Pay off our debts. You don't pay off your debt with revenue, you pay it off with income. Yes, the debt retirement doesn't show up on the income statement, it's on the balance sheet. Major capital investment. Who here wouldn't like a new building? These types of investments are investments that lead to growth or to an improved financial position. So then, again, let's go back to the beginning. What is a profit? A profit is a financial benefit that is realized when the amount of revenue gained from a business activity exceeds the expenses, costs, and taxes needed to sustain the activity. Those expenses I listed at the top, yes, we can defer them, but just because we're affording those expenses doesn't actually make us profitable. So many of us in the nonprofit sector think, oh, well, we can't pay people well enough because, you know, we're the nonprofit. We're not allowed to be, like, lining our pockets and so on. We can't have, you know, decent furnishings or, you know, comfortable quarters to work in or the latest technology. We think that's true because we're the nonprofit sector. And yet, ultimately, we need to continue to invest in our organization in order to ensure that we're successful long into the future. Yes? I didn't show you the whole definition from Investopedia before, but I'm showing it to you now. Again, this is a private sector definition. Any profit that is gained goes to the business's owners, who may or may not decide to spend it on the business. Here's the good news in the nonprofit sector. We have no shareholders. Nobody's getting a new car or a yacht from their dividend, from our organization. We have to invest all of our income back into our operations. And I hope that when we do that, once you've taken care of all those deferred expenses, you start thinking about growth. Oh, oh dear. The day is saved. So let's look at this with a little graphic, okay? Here's an organization that is subsisting. It's a nonprofit, so it has no net income. Revenues are in black, expenses are in red. You can see that they're equal. Hey, it's a nonprofit, yes? Here's that same nonprofit, but now it's healthy. Maybe that's $200,000 more of revenue. Maybe it's $20,000, right? But there's this equivalent amount of additional expense. But that equivalent revenue, that higher level, the incremental level of revenue and expense is now being invested in long-term sustainability. All those investments at the top that I talked about. Yes? We're paying people better. We're making sure we replace our IT. We're taking care of safety issues when they arise, and so on. This organization is now profitable. Yes? Revenue exceeds expense. It's potentially growing. If they take that incremental income and reinvest it in things that will allow the organization to grow. So to answer our question simply, profit is funds for growth. Oh, so then the question is, you might say, why? Why do we need to grow? And I have three answers. The first one, which I already gave away the punchline here. People say small is beautiful, and I agree with that. Small keeps us in close contact with our customers. We're not overly bureaucratic. We're not inefficient. We kind of get the job done, right? We all know that. We work hard in the nonprofit sector, right? Small is beautiful, but too small, frankly, is stupid. There are costs to running any organization, whether it's just complying with the law, whether it's making sure that your accounting is done to a standard, whether it's ensuring that you have an insurance policy, and all that good stuff. But all that stuff costs money. Even a photocopier costs quite a bit of money. Yes? If you're too small, all of those expenses that you cannot avoid take up too much of your budget. So I believe that we all have this sort of imperative to get a little bit bigger because it eases. The fixed costs don't necessarily go up. I mean, they do eventually, in depending on the type of organization you're running. But they don't necessarily go up immediately. So if we grow sort of to the limit of what we can carry, we've got that much more money to invest. What are we invested in? Oh, yeah, right. Our mission. So I'm here today talking to you about money. And I don't mind talking about money. But we're nonprofits, right? We're all here because we care deeply about some activity that we think the community just can't live without and that we're the people to deliver it for them. If we don't believe that, just get back in your car and drive down the hill or get back on your bike and drive down the hill. It is all about the mission. But here's a subtle point, and I think it's a point that's not necessarily well understood, but I think it's actually the most important in my most recent experience. And that is growth that we can create based on profit rather than getting a new grant or finding a new long-term contract is growth that we control. That's growth that we can direct where we see the need is greatest. And I'll say more about that as time goes on. Who agrees with this statement? Is this a pretty succinct statement of the challenge that we face in the nonprofit sector? Charities and nonprofits rely on three core sources of revenue: government funding, philanthropy, and earned income. Yeah? Okay. Here's the kicker. This report came out in 2011. Of these, only earned income offers any prospects for growth over the longer term. So why is that? Is it the government's fault? I mean, should we all be like going down to the legislature and waving our placards and beating our drums and so on? Yeah, maybe. you can see it both ways, or at least, you know, I feel like I can see it both ways. The government will say, hey, there was a recession, not just one, but two in the last 15 years, and they were painful. The population is growing, and it's aging, and an aging population is more expensive. There's inflation, there's a lower rate of growth in the economy, etc., etc., etc. It's a long list of reasons, but they'll say there's not enough money. On the other hand, when I look at government, from my perspective, I think they don't really understand the value that we add in the nonprofit sector. And that doesn't matter whether we're in the arts or whether we're in social service or any other sector. I don't see that they have a particular vision for what the sector could accomplish necessarily. They don't recognize, and this is a social sector thing, that the prevention that we do reduces acute costs, and that an investment in prevention might be saving $10 late, like a dollar invested in prevention might save $10 later. They don't coordinate between levels of government. There's a confusing regulatory environment that nonprofits and charities exist in, and so on. Okay, so maybe we'll let them off the hook, but not entirely. What about the big funding organizations, the philanthropists? They'll say, hey, those recessions hurt us too. There have been lower levels of donations since 2008. And donors are getting savvier. They really want to see results. It's not just enough to put their money into something and feel good. They want to know what it went for. They want to see concrete outcomes. As a person that has written these grant applications, I have a certain amount of frustration with the funding community. There's a focus on novelty and constantly shifting priorities. There's a focus on what I call shallow partnerships. So you write me a letter of support, I'll write you a letter of support, now we're partners. Right? Real partnerships cost money, but they want us to partner before we get the money. They're unwilling to fund core operating costs. Well, who's going to? Right? Nobody wants to pay overheads, and yet they do exist. There's an overemphasis on accountability. Now, I'm not afraid of accountability, but I used to work for the provincial government for BC Stats, and we did program evaluation of multi-million dollar programs. And yes, we'd do the logic model and the program evaluation report and etc. And we'd charge real money for that, $50,000, $100,000 for a program evaluation. A $5,000 grant does not require a logic model. The last one, and it bears saying, is there's a lack of coordination between funders. They want to see matching grants from another organization. So now I have to fill out two proposals in order to get one, or three, or four, and I have to be successful at more than one. What are the odds of that? Couldn't the funders coordinate? There's fewer of them than there are of us. Oh, I did it again. So then, is it the sector? If it's not the government, it's not the funders, at least not entirely, is it us? Well, some people have said maybe it is. I don't think you can blame the sector for all the stuff I want to blame on the government and the funders. So all that stuff on the right, on the left-hand side rather, governments have reduced funding, they're not funding inflation. My organization gets a $180,000 grant, not a grant, a contract, from an agency in the federal government that shall remain nameless. It's been $180,000 since the middle of the 1990s. So clearly we're doing less with that money today than we were then. Not saying that we shouldn't have been able to improve and become more efficient, but inflation has taken a mighty bite of that, hasn't it? On the other hand, what about us? I think personally that the writing's been on the wall for nonprofits since before the turn of the millennium, the century, whatever you want to think about it. By and large, we haven't embraced new models maybe as aggressively as we could have or should have. I think some organizations have tended to drift in their mission, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Others have tended to kind of hunker down and do what I call squat on a mandate, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. We haven't wanted to consider mergers, right? What if that 800, some of which are struggling, became 600 powerhouses? Right? Could we serve the community better? I think we need to focus on what we can control. I think there is a lot of finger pointing, and you know, I'm as guilty of it as anyone. My latest grant application gets rejected. Back away. Do you guys understand what I mean by mission drift and mandate squad? So I'm not going to go on and on about that. But I think when organizations experience this, where they either are too fluid in how they respond to changing priorities by themselves over 20 years, you think, what are they doing now? Didn't they used to be the guys that were doing that? It just confuses both the community and especially funders. Funders look at that and think, is this organization healthy? Is it in crisis? Are the board members who started with a mission over here going to be the same people who have followed that mission through three or four iterations and are now doing this? Or has it been like complete changeover in leadership every time? So too much instability is a bad thing, in my opinion. I've said that, in my opinion. Too much stability can also be a bad thing. It used to be sometimes you can all think of an organization that at one point had a certain amount of funding. For whatever reason, that sector was the in sector 5 years ago, 10 years ago. It's no longer the in sector. But they've had good leadership, it's been stable, they've figured out how to fill the gaps. They're still there. But 10 years, 15 years, 20 years later, they're still there, more or less doing the same thing. Again, that's great and good for the people that they serve, but the need is growing. Are you filling your mandate by staying the same size? Is anybody in the room confident that there's not a single thing more you could do to fill your mandate? I mean, I highly doubt it, right? I don't see a lot of hands going up. So we could always do more. But in order to do that, we need more resources. Yes? So when we're no longer the in sector, do we just hunker down and say, okay, well, you know, our time has passed, but maybe it'll come again in 20 years, and lobby, 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 lobby for more funding in our sector? Or do we get creative? I think this is the nub of the problem for organizations like all of ours. The greatest challenge for us is to be stable in the core of our mission and yet expand through time. So I'm like Goldilocks, right? I want it just right. Not too unstable, but not too stable. Just the right amount of instability. And at this point you're thinking, okay, Mr. Smarty Pants, you better have an answer.
This is CHLY 101.7 FM coming to you from Nanaimo, British Columbia. You're listening to People First Radio. We're on Twitter at People First Rad. We're sharing a presentation by Lee Herron, Executive Director of the Victoria-based social enterprise Fernwood NRG. Lee spoke at Startup Nanaimo's Profits for Nonprofits on conference. The day-long event was designed to provide information and opportunities for dialogue among representatives from non-profit organizations interested in creating revenue opportunities. You can find the video version of this talk on YouTube at People First Media Channel.
A social enterprise is not a typical business, but a business-like venture run by a non-profit organization. The profits earned by a social enterprise are reinvested back into the mission of the non-profit itself. Lee Herron's presentation continues.
We need to find ways to increase our revenues, and in so doing, we achieve greater control over our own destiny and greater control over the direction that we take with our mission. And if we can also find a way to generate net income or surplus, or the old-fashioned word, profit, then we can determine the direction that we will grow in to better fulfill our mission. It's a really exciting conversation to have at the board table when you say, how shall we invest our surplus this year? As opposed to, God help us, what are we going to do not go out of business this year? And I've been at both board tables, and I'm sure most of you have too. But how do we consistently be in that first table, right? Where we're debating about the best way to reinvest in our mission. That's fun and exciting, and that's where I think we all want to be. So, a little bit more theory first, and then we'll jump into action. What does it mean to be enterprising? I think, hands up, who's seen this continuum before of, on the one hand, the pure charities on the left-hand side of the continuum, and on the right-hand side, the guys with the top hats, the laissez-faire capitalists, the profit-maximizing businesses. It seems like most of you have seen this before. But this is understood as a continuum. The three types on the left are not-for-profit. They're democratically controlled in a one-member, one-vote type of way. The enterprises on the right-hand side are for-profit. They're capital-controlled. They're still democratic in the loose sense, but it's $1 or one share, one vote. Yes? The two in the middle, social enterprise and socially responsible business, they're kind of the new kids on the block, and by new I mean 15 years at least, right? That people have been talking about these concepts. Social enterprise is a business-like venture, and I use that phrase loosely because Revenue Canada sees a business as a profitable venture, and if you're running a business, you got issues, as a charity especially, also as a nonprofit. So social enterprise is a business-like venture, but it's owned by a nonprofit. A socially responsible business is a private entity, a corporation, but it's got a strong social or environmental mission or cause that's motivating it. Everybody gets this, right? But how many of the organizations that you represent fall neatly into any one of these boxes? No. That's where this model falls down, in my opinion, is that we all kind of are somewhere, and sometimes we're in different bins, yes? In different aspects of what we do. So this is an emerging model of being enterprising. And you can see there's a lot of stuff on there. Going back to the previous slide, the stuff that I've got in, like the color scheme is the same. The donations on pure like grant fundraising, that's all still in red. Fee-for-service, long-term contracts is the lighter pink color there. The purple, in this case, we've got social purpose real estate, social enterprise. Dark purple, in this case, the social venture. Blue, deep corporate partnerships. And I don't mean, you know, like we got 5,000 from the Royal Bank this year. I mean long-term agreements between charitable organizations and or nonprofits with members of the private sector to support movement and fulfillment of your mission over a long period of time. So this is just a slightly different way of thinking about it. But now, and I hope that this comes sort of more of a now I'm hoping this is going to be more of a stretch of your mind a little bit. And if you're not, then if it's not, then you're already there, okay? You could leave now. I'm not going to tell you anything you don't already know. Imagine if most or all of these streams were contained within one entity. Not necessarily all at once, but through time and strategically. Yes? That entity would be stable long term. If you're relying on the stuff in red only, it's going to be tough to fund your overheads. But if you've got these long-term contracts, you've got some fee-for-service work that you do, if you own your own building, you've got a business in that building that's part of your overall organization, and you have some partnerships on the side, funding your overheads is suddenly not your prime concern, right? And this entity long-term is also going to be expanding and building assets, because it's got many directions to grow in. If you get a great government that wants to give lots of grants, fantastic. Apply for them. You've got businesses that can, or activities that can hit on all of that. On the other hand, if you don't, you've got other directions to grow in. But hopefully you're trying to meet more and more of your mission all the time. It's about the mission. So here's my organization's story. So I'm with Fernwood Neighborhood Resource Group Society. We were incorporated in 1979. We serve a little neighborhood. It's the core black box there. It's called Fernwood. It's about 8 blocks from downtown. Downtown's just on the bottom of the map there. You can see it says Umtun. That's downtown, actually. The red is our organizational boundaries, and you can see that at some point we decided to annex half the city, but the black box is the core of the neighborhood according to the city's own boundaries. Like I said, we were formed in 1979. We were formed to manage a building. The city built the building. They got infrastructure funding from what was called the Neighborhood Improvement Program in the late 1970s. The building was built. They didn't want to operate it, so they created and worked with the community to create a nonprofit to manage the building. We were initially incorporated as the Fernwood Facilities Management Group. It's pretty thrilling, hey? We still manage the building, but I don't think that we've been squatting on our mandate. But for a long time, if I'm honest, I think we did. We saw ourselves as a building, right? Our mission was to manage the building. In fact, we later changed our name before we changed it to Fernwood NRG. We changed it to the Fernwood Community Center Society. And our purpose was to administer, set policies, and all that other good stuff for the building. We didn't see ourselves as playing a role in the health and well-being of the whole neighborhood, just the building. So this is the fiscal year ending March 31st, 1997. The red boxes represent grants, purple long-term contracts, blue earned income, black assets. We didn't have any, see any black on there? No. Orange liabilities. I'm going to use this sort of shot a few times, well, more than a few times, to sort of give you an idea how our evolution progressed, as I also show you, hopefully, some inspiring photos. But you can see that we weren't that big. We're still not that big. We're quite a bit bigger, but we're not that big. I've adjusted these figures for inflation. What that has done in the way that I've done it, and I used to work at BC Stats, right? I've indexed it to 2014 equals 100. What that means is dollars in the past look bigger than they were. So our budget wasn't 800,000 then, it was less. But these are today's dollars, okay? So it gives you a relative perspective, because 20 years is a long time and inflation plays a role over time. So that's what we looked like. Most of our earned income in those days came from childcare, and a significant portion of it still does. That building is a great benefit that has propped our organization up over a long term. We pay $1 a year for that building, and we operate it under agreement with the city. We don't pay the operating costs of the building, but we have to manage the building. The building has many deficiencies. In the early years, it was more of a liability than it was an asset. But now we've worked over the years to invest in the building, and now it is a real asset for us and allows us to generate earned income. A year later, this is before I got involved, the organization had a surplus, it got some assets back, but not a lot was changing. Oh, a year later, see that? The structure, like a little bit, you know, we got a little bit more grants, we had a little bit less earned income. I wasn't involved then, I don't know the whys and wherefores of all that, but you could see, you know, it's roughly the same size. Okay, here's our big break. We got given a house. Again, at the time, it did not look like this. This is after we invested $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 into making it a beautiful house. It was not in this shape when we received it. And yet, it was a real asset. Another charity went defunct voluntarily, and they had been given this house themselves in the 60s. And so they put out a request for proposals. But our organization saw that this house was available, and we jumped on it because we wanted to build assets. Yes, there's a responding to opportunity. Yes, there's a good break. But you have to have that orientation that societies, charities need assets in order to thrive. And like I said, we had to take on a certain amount of risk and make a certain amount of investment to make this asset valuable to us. Yes, it made our balance sheet look good initially, but it was a drain. We had to pay property taxes, utilities, we had to insure it, and it was generating no income. So how is that an asset? Many of you may be asking yourself the same question if you bought a place. Things didn't change that fast in those days. Again, we had maybe another surplus. We paid off a little bit of debt. We added a little bit more earned income. They're pretty pokey times. A little bit more. Grants. Our grants were still growing. So people thought, hey, it was good times. Unfortunately, it wasn't great times in our neighborhood. This article came out in 2002. The injection drug trade had moved into Victoria, and eventually the merchants and the police and the city fathers and mothers banded together and said, we need this out of downtown. Guess where it ended up? It ended up in our neighborhood. It's a residential neighborhood with a couple schools, not much commercial activity. We didn't really have a hope. We were just completely overwhelmed by this. I think that we actually let ourselves run a deficit in 2003, which is why that liability is creeping up again. It's probably payables and other amounts owing. March 31st, 2004 was when you really started to see the contraction. So if I go back there, you can see we lost both earned income and grants in that fiscal year. We operated most of that fiscal year without an executive director. We ran with a management team. We cut everything we could think of cutting. And I think we turned in a surplus, but it was because we had shed senior management salaries. We also got news in that fiscal year that we had, for April 1st, lost a long-term contract. So the walls are starting to close in. Meanwhile, the boards had gone up on a building, commercial building, in the heart of our neighborhood. So from the outside, yeah, the windows were smashed. It was all boarded up. Upstairs, it was a squat. There were open dealing going on in the neighborhood. All of the commercial activity, what commercial activity there was in the heart of the neighborhood, had dried up. It felt unsafe. I personally never felt unsafe, but I know that, you know, a lot of people felt unsafe, and bad things did happen to some folks. There's no doubt about it. It was not a healthy neighborhood.
This is CHLY 101.7 FM from Nanaimo, British Columbia. You're listening to People First Radio. We're sharing a presentation by Lee Herron, Executive Director of the Victoria-based social enterprise Fernwood NRG. Lee spoke at Nanaimo's Profits for Nonprofits on conference. The day-long event was designed to provide information and opportunities for dialogue among representatives from nonprofit organizations interested in creating revenue opportunities. You can find the video version of this talk on YouTube at our People First Media channel.
Lee Herron shared key information and lessons learned from Fernwood NRG's shift to being enterprising a decade ago. Fernwood NRG currently operates licensed daycares, manages affordable housing units, publishes a community newspaper, organizes annual neighborhood festivals, and operates the Cornerstone Cafe. Here's Lee Herron.
Here we are a year later. You can see that the pressure's on a little bit. One thing we did do in that fiscal year, though, was we did hire a new executive director. Roberta was fantastic. Roberta looked around at the community need and said, there is a huge need for infant and toddler care. We're already in the daycare business. Maybe we should expand in that direction. So we set it up, we got licensed, and we opened. And so you can see that even though the long-term contracts are declining, the earned income is starting to creep back up, right? We didn't have a full year of operations in this fiscal year, only a part year. But we were starting to move. And that's what some of those incremental liabilities are for. Again, we took a risk to invest. Now, yes, we invested in our own building. It's on leased property. We didn't have a long-term lease, just a long-term lease. So, we again, taking a risk, though, right? But trying to find a community need in that fee-for-service bin. Yes, there are some grants that are attached to nonprofit childcare or funding streams. Let's call them CCOF for those who are in the know, childcare operating funding. But it's mainly fees. One of the things that we did do, though, was we started thinking. And we really started putting the pressure on ourselves to meet the challenge that the neighborhood was facing. And, you know, I had the key, the master key to the building as the president, of course, you know, right? So that was my big honor to go to meetings and meetings and meetings and meetings and try to talk to City Hall and so on and so forth to get someone to see the value in this neighborhood. we had gone through a failed merger process. There's another organization in Fernwood. I'm not going to go into the details, but we had proposed to merge with them in 2004, and ultimately that process had not succeeded. The pro-merger people on the other board joined our board, and we sat together and said, okay, what are we going to do? We quickly settled on the idea that in order to bring about the change we wanted to see in the neighborhood and bring back the good times, which was our motivation then, it wasn't sort of forward-looking, it was more bring back something that had been, we decided we needed to figure out how to buy that building. And we thought about it and thought about it and thought about it, but it was a boarded-up building with no income. You cannot finance the purchase, unless you have very deep pockets, you cannot finance the purchase of a boarded-up building with no income. The bank looks at that and says, yeah, you need income to retire that debt. So what did we do? We took a gigantic risk. We swapped our house. Remember that beautiful house that we had made so beautiful? We swapped our house for this wreck. And a $700,000 vendor take-back mortgage. I was prepared to fail because nobody else was willing to put investment back into the neighborhood. So we had to step up and find a way to do it ourselves. Just for fun, we created our own newspaper, which is turning 10 in June. We put the paper out for the first time in June of 2005, so we'd have somewhere to print the news when the sale went through in August. But it's still going. This is what our fiscal year end looked like. So we had added assets, but we'd also added a considerable amount of liabilities. Our earned income was still growing. We did bring in quite a bit of grants in order to make that project start to become a reality. But yeah, risk. We took a risk. Here's what it looked like. We put up flags. We invited everyone down to the square. We held work parties. The guy on the left, the skinny guy with the hat, I don't know who he is. the gal on the right, she was the vice president at that time. Anybody recognize her? You guys are from, all of 100 kilometers away. She's now the mayor of Victoria. That's right. She was pretty young then, too. We built four three-bedroom units of affordable housing upstairs. We put geothermal heating in. We redeveloped a commercial space on the ground floor of the building. We also picked up some awards along the way. We brought the building back, right? And we brought back a healthy core of our neighborhood. That was the same building that I showed you earlier that was boarded up. And we did that by taking a big risk. But when we took that risk, the community also stepped up, right? Our grants, going back to this slide here, were as high then as they've ever been, right? Because we were doing something that people wanted to get behind. Most of the grants we brought in, though, like from CMHC and others, were in fact capital grants. So you remember that honeycomb thing I showed you? Capital grant is building an asset. It's not operating money. But that asset generates income over time that you can use to operate. I tell you which one I would rather get, right? We then had a debate. Hey, we need income. Shouldn't we just lease out the ground floor to whoever will pay the market rate? And then we decided, actually, that's right. We need income. A coffee shop on that corner is going to make a fortune, we said. Ha, ha, ha. We should open our own. So, as if we weren't busy enough, we did just that. And we bootstrapped this with, there's always, all the way through, there's funding from here, funding from there, but we were using these investments as much as we could. I mean, we got funding from ENP to do a feasibility study. I wrote the feasibility study, and we put the 10 grand into the cafe startup, right? So we were always finding ways to generate as much capital coming in. And it was never enough. You remember this slide here with the orange? Yeah, we got lots of debt to fill. Here's how we looked at the end of 2007. So that earned income is still growing now. Grants had shrunk a little bit. liabilities and assets, like the equity portion versus liabilities, are more in balance. The green is the first box of our social enterprise revenue. Then, I don't know, we're crazy, I think, when I think back about it. We're being urged by our funders. Hey, you guys were so successful with that project, you need to do another one. So we took another risk, and we bought two vacant lots a couple blocks over. Two lots in Victoria, eight blocks from downtown, could be purchased in those days for $300,000. But that's what we looked like at 2008. Yeah, we had a little bit more assets, but we also had a lot more liabilities. But you can see that our social enterprise was also starting to grow, and our earned income is continuing to grow through this period. In September 2008, we opened this beautiful sixplex. Again, affordable family housing, all three-bedroom units. We brought in over $1 million of capital grants at that time. Now, you might say, oh yeah, well, if we had $1 million of capital grants, we could do that too. And it's true, you could. But does anybody think about that? September 2008, what happened around then? Yeah, so the world economy plunged off a cliff literally no later than we had cut the ribbon on this. And so we got out really just in time. The capital streams that came into this, both public and private, largely dried up for years. I don't know if they're all back yet, but most of them, you know, are trickling back. So we were lucky, again. But we wanted to build assets. It was the orientation that made this possible. We could have said, no, it's too much risk. We've got this new building, we've got our new business, it's enough. But we didn't say that. And we might have failed too. But remember what I said? I was willing to fail. Although I was getting less willing to fail as we got more successful. When we were completely already failing, I was ready to fail outright. Now, I'm less excited about failing. Remember when I said we brought in $1 million of capital? Look what that did to our assets there, our equity. So we took the risk by buying the property up front, but the funders had committed that they would come through, and they did. And our social enterprise revenue is still growing. I became ED in this particular fiscal year. We had made a decision just before I started. We made a decision to cease our operations of off-site childcare in the school for various reasons, which I won't go into. But that was costly. You can see, even though it was only halfway through the fiscal year we made that decision, that it already started to chew into our earned income. The full impact of that decision didn't happen until the following year. My first priority as ED, though, you know, once I sort of settled into the job, was, okay, we've got these assets, how do we ensure that we can maintain them for the long term? So I was more focused on getting the core organization initially. We started looking at our festival. Fernfest is a great summer festival. We turned it from a money loser into break even. We then bolted on a fundraiser using all the same infrastructure that we had to buy for the festival. We created a ticketed event in partnership with the business community. This fundraiser brings in, I don't know, $15,000, $20,000. But that's discretionary income, which is fantastic. We held a neighborhood visioning forum. We invited everyone down to come and talk to us about what the new vision for the neighborhood should be, since we're no longer this failed neighborhood with the boarded up building. Had lots of people come out and talk to us on a Saturday morning. We published the results back to the neighborhood. The neighborhood wanted to see greater food security, more affordable housing, and more commercial activity. We knew that the funding had dried up for affordable housing, so we didn't overcommit on that. But we said, hey, we'll get right on that food security stuff. You can see, you know, things are stabilizing, but also continuing to grow. This year we ran a deficit, the biggest deficit that we've ever run, and I'm not proud to be, again, the weak leader in charge of that operation, but we were in a period of restructuring. We were also still feeling the impact of having given away that. So even though our earned income was growing underneath, it was growing from a smaller base than it had been, so that was a challenge for us. The restructuring plan that we presented to the members was approved, In 2012, we created a subsidiary company. We reapplied to CRA Charity Directorate, and we were readmitted as a charity. We also started to move on our new part of our mission that the members in the community had set for us, which is they wanted to see more action on food security. We took over the operations of the Victoria Good Food Box from the Victoria or Capital Region Good Food Society, which was going defunct. Why? Because they didn't have money for their overheads. But our overheads were already funded, so we just said, well, throw it on. No problem. We're moving into food, so this will give us a good entree into that. We created a family dinner. The food comes, this is weekly, it's by donation. The food is donated, again, that deep corporate partnership. Cold Star Freight has a long-term partnership with the Coalition of Neighborhood Houses. Almost all the food comes from them. We put in the labor and, you know, the consumables and so on, and we make the space available. But this has been a great way for families to meet and mingle. 100 people come every week to this. It's fantastic. We worked with the city to put more installations around. All this stuff costs money, but we had money. Once we restructured, you know, we were sort of confidently back in the black, let's say, so we could make these investments. This one in partnership with the city. 25 fruit trees on one side of the community center. We put a kitchen garden in the front of the community center. The city had been downloading by not maintaining the garden, so we said, well, if we're going to maintain it, it's got to be something useful rather than a bunch of ornamental plants. So we put in a community garden. This was funded by our partners and friends at the Fernwood Inn, who is a great establishment. I encourage you to go there. But, yeah, they gave us a very generous donation from some of their own fundraising activities to make this happen in the neighborhood, half a block away. This is how we looked at March 31st, 2013. So you can see now that the company is a separate subsidiary taxable corporation. It doesn't pay a lot of tax. We can go into that after. But that's where we were. And then, just when I thought, hey, things are getting comfortable again, opportunity knocked. We learned that the four yellow properties in the core of Fernwood Village were for sale. We own this one. This is the Cornerstone building, the one across the street. This is the Fernwood Inn that I was talking about. And these other four were for sale from the same vendor. This is one of the houses. So these are ripe for redevelopment, especially given their location. That's this property here, 1310. And then a neighborhood business was potentially going out of business. A hair salon that had been open for 14 years in Fernwood Square basically terminated their lease with the landlord there and was going to wind up. The owner had been in business for a long time. She didn't want to start over. So we sat down with her. There were some tears. But we said, hey, what if? We came to a mutually beneficial agreement, and 3 weeks later, we moved out of our offices, knowing that we were going to buy this place a few months later. So we were itinerant for a few months. We moved out of our offices, renovated, and we reopened as a hair salon, Studio 1313, 3 months later. But guess what? We had a company now, right? The company is completely, its purpose is to make a profit. We have other criteria for investment as well, which I'll share at the very end. But we said, why wouldn't we do this? The owner of the salon is willing to come and work for us on contract for a couple of years while she finishes out her career. We could set this up, it could run, and it's a great service that's needed in the neighborhood. So our business now can start to grow also, which is a benefit of our new structure. This is what it looks like after the reno. It's not a huge business, but right now it's successfully generating roughly about $1,000 a day in revenue. So we bought those new properties with debt, and so this looks a little bit out of balance now, and it's going to look a little bit more out of balance in the next slide. This is what we're proposing for that little house. But just one quick point. You can see our earned income is still still increasing, as well as the company revenue is increasing with the salon, right? The earned income is increasing because the other property, we bought two of the four, not all four of them. The other property that we bought is leased to another charity, as it turns out. So, you know, there's income flowing from these assets, right? This is what we're proposing. The architect, the builder, the lawyer that did the legal work on this, They're all contributing in various ways pro bono to this. Again, deep corporate partnerships. They want to see us succeed. They want to be part of us, of our success. You just work on these relationships through time. And you know what? StatCan does research. You know why most people don't give to charity? Nobody asked them. You said it, right? So if you ask, you never know what might happen. This is what we look like today. But again, this is a temporary state of affairs. As we start to move into the building, hopefully we'll be able to attract some further capital investment from other parts of the community. The black part will go up. The orange part will go up a little bit. But it's still within risk tolerances that the bank is comfortable with. But you can see now, we've got $1 million of earned income, $700,000 of corporate revenue, and how much grants? I don't write a lot of grant proposals. I kind of feel like I'm wasting my time. We're not very successful. And I don't know whether that's because I have the wrong attitude going into it, which is actually probably most of the problem, or whether people feel we don't need the money. I don't know what it is. But on the other hand, I've got a communications person. Is she funded? No. We fund her. We're doing more on our mission. We're doing community dinner. We're building a neighborhood orchard. We're putting gardens in and so on. All that takes money to install and maintain. And we're not waiting around for a grant to do that. We're just making it all happen. So I hope that what you're seeing here is an empowered organization that, yes, is taking risk, and I sure hope I'm not the guy that blows up this organization. But on the other hand, we're taking a direct stake in the future of our neighborhood. We're putting our resources directly back to work serving people in the neighborhood. And we're not waiting for external third parties to say, oh yes, that sounds like a good idea, you should do that. And last but not least, can operate in space that we own or control. Now this is a big one for us. If you don't have your own space, you might have to compromise on this one. But one of the big risks of any small business is your relationship with your landlord long term. If we're our own landlord or our other corporate entity is our landlord, it mitigates one of the biggest risks that a small business faces. All of these things work together for us to make taking on new challenges less risky than it would otherwise be. And this has been evolved over a long time of thinking about it.
Lee Heron is Executive Director of the Victoria-based social enterprise Fernwood NRG. Lee spoke at Startup Nanaimo's Profits for Nonprofits on conference. You can find Fernwood NRG online at fernwoodnrg.ca. You can find Startup Nanaimo online at startupnanaimo.ca. And you can find the video version of today's People First Radio episode on YouTube at People First Media.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio on demand. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpages.